Hello and welcome to the March 2014 episode of the Bike Portland podcast about bikes and low-car life in PDX. I'm Lillian Kerbake.
I'm Jonathan Maas.
And I'm Michael Anderson. Each month, the three of us go in-depth on a subject that matters to Portlanders who get around without a car.
And we do it in the time that it takes the average Portlander to get to work.
Part of our goal for this show is to give you a chance to sit in on the conversations and arguments we have with one another. And that's definitely what we're doing today.
Because Jonathan and Lily and I talk and think about this subject quite a lot.
We're going to talk about bicycle advocacy.
Who speaks for people that ride bikes, and what do they say?
And why do they say it?
And who do they say it to?
And how are their long-term strategies
and their short-term tactics
changing?
We're eager to get into it.
So I want to start with the groundwork for this, just for folks who aren't really plugged into the bicycle advocacy scene, don't may not know what it means or who the players are. Who are the major bike advocacy groups we're talking about when we talk about action for bikes that affects Portlanders?
Well, there's the Bicycle Transportation Alliance, I think, is the main face of bicycle advocacy in Portland, for sure.
And that's a local group.
They work statewide and in Southwest Washington, which is just so that they can include Vancouver. The work that the BTA does is, I think, about half programmatic, which is the Safe Routes to School program is kind of one of their flagship programs, which gets kids walking and biking to school. But the thing that they tend to be known for and the thing that people talk the most about is actually their advocacy work, which is representing cyclists in City Hall, in the state legislature, wherever they can be kind of pushing the bike agenda.
Yeah, and increasingly, the Community Cycling Center, in terms of impact in Portland, they're having a more and more larger impact, I think, on the bike advocacy sphere. We tend to call them the CCC for short. They do a lot of programmatic work in terms of getting folks in low-income communities and underserved communities on bikes. So they have a lot of outreach programs to sort of create a commuter kind of stuff. But they're also looking to have a bigger voice for those issues, actually, in terms of the policy realm and the related policies of those things, and sort of increasing the tent of advocacy and who's involved with making these decisions and policies.
So this is the nonprofit bike shop on Alberta.
Right.
And they're using some of their money to run this bike shop and getting some revenue from it. And they're also doing a bunch of sort of political and policy work around, like, making sure that bikes are useful to poor people and disadvantaged people of various sorts and so on.
Right. And now they're wanting to literally change the face of the advocacy conversation by bringing the people that have been benefiting from their programs, actually bringing them into the city hall conversations and the policy setting conversations and the project outcomes.
Cool. And this show is also inspired by all three of us being at this recent event in DC that was put on by the League of American Bicyclists, which is sort of, and stop me if I'm wrong, guys, it's like a national BTA, basically. They're looking at federal policy, they're looking at state policy sort of on a systematic level, in the same way the BTA might look at local policy, trying to coordinate the efforts of various groups and making sure that people in Congress and the federal government know about the best ways to do bike.
Yeah, and the basic idea of the National Bike Summit happens every year. Is everybody goes to DC. I think there's 700 or so advocates from all over the country. And there's a lot of educational stuff, info session kind of stuff. And then there's a day when we go up on Capitol Hill and do the lobbying and visit the members of Congress offices and tell them what we think about biking and why they should love it too.
Cool. So there are lots of groups involved, but those are the sort of the biggest three probably for Portlanders, I would think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we've been talking about this a lot just in the office because of the summit. And so coming back, thinking about, well, what's the state of advocacy right now? So it's a good time to talk about these things.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to start the conversation with is what bike advocacy meant to us when we first got into biking. All three of us got into bikes first as users, I think, and then later became politically aware. Who did we think the bike advocates were, and what did we think that they did? Maybe start with Lily. You want to talk about your
I really had no concept of bike advocacy when I first started biking beyond like critical mass. Like, I really thought that the public voice of bikes was critical mass. You know, this wasn't in Portland, clearly. It was in Boston and Cincinnati. And, I didn't really have a perception of professional advocacy for bikes. I didn't have the suits and ties idea. And when I went to my first, bicycle advisory committee for Cincinnati's Bike Master Plan, it's entirely a room full of men in their, late 50s, early 60s who had been sitting on that committee for 25 years. Hmm. And as far as I could tell, they really, hadn't done much. Like, we didn't have any infrastructure or anything. There was a bicycle master plan in Cincinnati that was approved in the 80s and none of it had been built. And things have really changed in Cincinnati in the past couple of years. And I think a large part of that is that, now their advocacy, they have an advocacy group, Queen City Bike, and they have an executive director who's, a young, vivacious woman in her 20s who's smart and represents cycling in a very different, visible way. And having the face of cycling not be the face that you would expect to see show up at those meetings, I think has made a huge difference in their ability. But also just that the tide is changing. Like, no longer does the mayor's office go, why would you want to talk to me about bikes? Or like, oh no, let's talk about bikes. Like, what can we do?
What about you, Jonathan?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, my experience with this type of sort of political bike advocacy definitely started when I moved to Portland to some degree. I mean, back in Santa Barbara, I did some work around trail access, mountain bike trail access. But for the most part, understanding nonprofits and how they interact with politics around biking started when I moved here kind of like in 2005. I started looking around and seeing what the different groups were doing. I mean, I guess when I first came, my perception of it was that there's, just this really nice, one convenient bucket where all the voices for biking kind of fits in. And whatever people say in that underneath that tent is must be good. And it's just all fall in line and kind of speak together kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It was kind of hunky-dory. And I think it matched sort of the feeling of the time. I think 2005, 2006 in Portland, we were really rising and there's a lot of excitement. And I think there's obviously been a big change in terms of my perception of all that in the ensuing years. And I think that's a natural thing that just comes with actually understanding more in more detail how this works and who's doing what and why. And, to some extent, I'm just a little more cynical about the stuff that I've learned. And also, I think a big realization is the fact that it's not just one simple sort of voice for biking. The people that care about biking in this town represent tons of different voices. Mm-hmm. And obviously, being the publisher of Bike Portland and seeing tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of comments over all these years, those are the voices of people in Portland. You start to realize it's not quite as simple and neat and tidy as I used to think it was.
So what's an example of something you would have thought in 2005 is like, well, is it good for bikes? Yes or no? And now it's like, well, one or the other.
Well, one that might stand out is this angst we're having about protected bike lanes.
Yeah.
I think even the national advocacy movement has sort of been under this impression that they're obviously good. Separate bikes from cars is great. But from the first day they were mentioned in a big way publicly here in Portland, there was a naysayer.
Yeah.
And that thread of naysayers, even among people who ride bikes, and that's important, it's not just the haters, right? Because they're just going to hate it for whatever reason. It's actually people that ride bikes, and there's these differences of opinion about, whether a protected bike lane is going to be good here or there and whether that person wants to ride in it. And so important, that's actually had a real big impact on the advocate's ability to move that stuff forward, because the people in positions of power look at the quote-unquote bike community, and they want 100% endorsement for these big ideas. Uh-huh. And as soon as they start to realize that, well, it's more like 60-40, or there's all these differences of opinion,
right,
it makes things a lot more complicated. And I think that's been a challenge for advocacy groups to try to figure out how to deal with that.
And the thing that somebody would say against a protected bike lane is that it's harder to get into and out of. It's mm-hmm. People are less likely to notice you if they're in a car and they're going to right hook you.
Well, and a little bit of it, actually has to do with enforcement around parking and what ends up happening. You know, what did happen when we opened our first supposedly cycle track, which wasn't really a cycle track, which was a protected bike lane by PSU. Everybody just used it as a, ooh, look, I've got a protected parking lane. And it took like a long time for the enforcement to really, to match up with the dream of this. But then meanwhile, cars were very upset when you were using the main lane because they're like, you have a lane over there. Yeah. And we have a mandatory side path law in Oregon. So the mandatory side path law means that if there is a bike facility available to use, you must use it. So if there's a bike lane on the road, you must use it. There's a few exceptions written into that, but you can leave to get around debris and things like that. But a lot of people are very upset because we have a mandatory side path law about providing facilities and roadways where they think it might be better mm-hmm. to be able to take the full lane.
Right. So it's sort of a divide between people who are comfortable riding in traffic and people who want any other option available.
Right. I think the important piece of this issue for the advocacy organizations right. is in this new environment. And I think this change from 2005 to now, let's say, there's also been this amazing rise in people's ability to speak their voice. Uh-huh. There's this thing called social media and independent publishing.
Yeah,
you know?
I heard about that.
Yeah, it's this thing. So imagine how different it was before that.
Yeah.
The advocacy groups had an email list. That email list, or our membership, quote unquote, of right. a group like, let's say, the BTA, that was the voice for bicycling. Yeah,
that's
in
a
Portland.
Great point. Oh man,
that has changed dramatically.
Yep,
that is no longer this like sort of fundamental pillar of what the quote unquote bike community thinks. So, you get into an issue like protected bike lanes, which are highly controversial and you know locally and nationally in some ways. And it's like I think for advocacy groups, it's really hard for them to figure out how to harness power and energy around an idea when everybody's arguing with each other.
Well, and something that I've really noticed just as a perpetual stakeholder advisory committee sitter is that it's the way that people talk about bikes has really changed in meetings, partially as a result of what you're saying. Like more people come to things like the Burnside High Crash Corridor. I cannot believe how many people showed up at a meeting on a weekday night. 45 people showed up just to talk about a 10 block stretch of Burnside. This is the kind of thing that when I first started doing advocacy, you know, 5-6 years ago, that you really rarely saw that. Each of those people that shows up, like you said, gets to be a voice. And now,
were they mobilized by BTA or something?
No, not at all. Not at all.
They heard about it. So we didn't write about it. So
no. Well, the PBOT does go around and tell people that it's coming up.
Yeah.
But now more and more people, I think, feel like willing or like they have a place to talk.
That's great news.
Talk about transportation meetings. But one of the things I find really fascinating is it used to be I'd go and I would be like, I am the transportation advocate. And now at a meeting like Burnside High Crash Corridor, literally every single person on that is like, oh, I ride my bike. Like I ride my bike sometimes. Because as we increase our mode share and people's identity as someone who cycles even occasionally, there's so much more awareness of cycling issues. But like,
which
you
is
said,
great.
Right.
Like we've never been a voting bloc. It always seemed nuts to me that like it was perceived as an
endorsement you needed to get
right, exactly.
in
like,
Portland.
Oh, that the 4% of daily bicycles or whatever, that's a minuscule number of votes you're going to swing with that. But so it really like, it seems like the point of all of the advocacy is just how can we make bicycling of benefit to all the other things we want in the city? And like, how can bikes be part of making prosperous businesses and safe streets and things that help everybody, right?
Well, and you get very little, you don't get the same amount of pushback now in a central city neighborhood association meeting or business meeting. People don't say like there is no place for bikes on the road anymore. You really don't hear that. Even sitting on like the committee I'm on right now is in a freight industrial area, and you don't hear people say like I don't even want bikes on the road. They're just like, how do we make it safe, and how do we make sure like not have bikes sharing the same road as semis? The conversation has shifted, at least in Portland, away from the idea like we don't have to justify the existence of bikes anymore.
Yeah, and that's one of the key, if not the key challenge right now, is I kind of think of it as this implementation gap. And everybody, mm-hmm. at least in my perception, everybody in the local sort of advocacy sphere is struggling to deal with this. And I mean everybody from PBOT staff to state people to local leaders and advocacy folks is there's this gap. So we're at the table now. That's kind of what, the league at the summit had this research showing that mayors around the country in this survey said, yeah, biking's definitely at the table. But the question is, do we have the right manners? Do we know how to interact now? And are we able to actually turn this, hey, we love biking kind of support, or this new acceptance of biking and all these different tables, can that be turned into projects and policies that improve bicycling? Partly it's the challenge from advocacy groups of having to change. Change is really hard. The bigger you get in any organization, that's just standard. That's what happens. And so you have to imagine, like in the VTA's example, they've gotten so much bigger over the years, and the conversation that they're involved in, the activity that they're involved in, and the people involved in that activity has changed dramatically. Now, has that organization changed commensurately with the change on the ground? They have to struggle with this idea of, you know, staying relevant as bicycling's changed so fast. I mean, if you believe some people, there's this urban revolution going on.
Right.
Have advocacy organizations revolutionize themselves to sort of stay on top of that.
How would they do that? What would that even
look like? That's a good point. You know, I mean, if they were, that's a big question. If they were based on this idea of fighting for bikes and trying to say, we're here, and, you know, sort of that rah-rah, now that everybody knows we're here and it's sort of like politically not even cool to trash bikes anymore, what does that mean for advocacy groups? Should they focus more on programmatic work and grants, or should they, I mean, how do they stay relevant?
I know what I want to see. I know what I think is the future of advocacy work for bicycling. I believe that we fundamentally need to change what the face of advocacy is. Bicycling has changed, and we know what communities respond to. We know what cities respond to. They like to see that kids are cycling. They like to see low-income families that feel comfortable cycling. We're not good at translating the stories of people that do that and empowering them to actually be their own voice. We end up using these stories as tokens and anecdotes rather
What's
than...
What's the difference?
What I propose is really far more of a training program that is being able to advocate in your own community and especially in your own neighborhood and organization. So, okay, you're involved with Hacienda, CDC. We will come and give you a scholarship to participate in our 10-month training program. That's a monthly program where we actually teach you how to run a campaign around a new street. And that way, the voice of the people that want to get Cully bike lanes is actually coming from the people in the neighborhood rather than the BTA saying, we need to go get a cycle track in Cully. So now we're going to approach and partner with those organizations.
Is BTA going to pay Hacienda CDC to hire that person to run the 10-month campaign?
People apply to it when they want to start working on campaigns.
Right.
And they're part of their work plan, hopefully, at their organization that they work with, or just part of their neighborhood advocacy in their volunteer position, then becomes, oh, we want safer streets. Because it's the thing you hear. I mean, if you're involved in grassroots advocacy and neighborhood advocacy, especially in lower-income communities in places like East Portland, safe streets is a thing that communities want.
Absolutely.
But the tools to get there are still very obtuse, and it can seem very slow moving compared to other kind of small hyperlocal advocacy campaigns, because transportation wonkery is very inaccessible. And we see that people want to show up to meetings and want to have input on these things, but then we have to talk about like really specific like angles and everything, the kind of stuff that we geek out about, but we learned over many years of being involved in this work. And, I did the Land Use Leadership Initiative training program with 1,000 Friends of Oregon, which was kind of similar to what I described. And a lot of it was just learning that like land use is very complicated, but here are the resources to be able to figure out how you find out what you need to find out when you want to make a change in your own community.
Yeah, so it's sort of like you're saying the BTA becomes more of a service organization providing this service and less of a advocacy leadership program sort of organization. And what you said also reminds me of the PSU class that exists right now, the traffic and transportation class. But if you look at the makeup of the people who go to that class,
yeah,
it's not exactly, you know, folks outside, you know, outside 82nd Avenue or in other places. You know, you see the pretty regular, it's kind of like your urban planning students, your really involved citizen activist type.
Yeah.
So
part of it is that the channels that class gets advertised in are the channels where people that are already the urban planning people and the central city neighborhood advocates. And that class is actually a really good example of something that could be maybe a better partnership for recruiting people that...
We'll link to this on the blog.
Through organizations. Yeah, no. Mm-hmm. PSU Traffic and Transportation class. It's free for neighborhood activists every fall for 20 years? 20 years now, I think?
Yeah.
It's been around a long time.
Jonathan, what do you think about the sort of service model? I feel like that's stop me if I'm wrong, but I feel like that's not your usual vision for where the BTA would be most effective.
I don't think so. I mean, I think the BTA would be most effective in doing more community organizing. You know, we have an idea, a concept, a thing that wins politically. Safe streets, better access for bicycling, and all the benefits that bicycling brings. Yet we have an organization that's become, you know, more and more conservative, less likely to sort of be out in the street organizing people around this idea and coalescing all that power that could make a really strong case. Instead, and this is, you know, just part of their strategic sort of direction, and it's not a bad one, it's just a different one. I think the BTA is trended more toward the suit and tie, being at the table of power, partnering with people of power. And that is a sort of seductive way to go. It seems like it makes sense.
It's not a bad one. It's just a different one. What?
It's
And then I'm going to continue to trash it.
Well, to some degree, I think it's fraught with risk. That's the thing. I think if you can play it right, but there's also a risk involved, which is getting too close to the people that you're supposed to be, you know, questioning and supposed to be watchdogging. And I think that's been the case here in Portland. There's been a lot of back padding and a lot of, hey, we're great. Well, thank you for being so awesome and you're great and all this stuff. And telling good stories and telling success stories and stuff has power, but I think it's very limited. And I think we're way beyond that in Portland and Oregon to some degree. And it's something I noticed on the Hill during lobby day. You know, we even had people leading the meetings before the meeting saying, hey, this is going to be easy. These folks love bicycling. You know, Earl Blumenauer loves bicycling. Representative DeFazio loves bicycling. You know, most of our 7 members of Congress are pretty supportive of what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so this idea that it's going to be easy, we're going to walk in there, they're going to support our stuff. So it was more just a love fest, telling them all these great successes. Yeah. So the thing is, like, we need to actually get strong, organize a community around this idea, but and make some big
asks.
What
does that look like? See, my problem with this idea is that, my own problem anyway, is that the, like, so we get 300 people. Best case scenario, 300 people show up to something at City Hall. That's 300 voters. Like, politicians are going to say, oh, this is an indication that there are 3,000 voters who really care about this. But, like, it's not really a big show of force. It's just a vocal minority. And I feel like it's perceived as such unless you have the sort of diversity of interest groups that would theoretically come out of the system like Lily describes. So, like,
yeah, I agree.
Let me use an example. My friend Kyle, who is also one of Lily's bosses, but he had this great campaign called Friends of Barber that advocated for some changes to Barber Boulevard that were not forcing bikes and cars to merge at 40 miles an hour. And the coverage of it in media and the perception of it was all Friends of Barber neighborhood group, et cetera. And then the BTA, to their credit, realized this was an important issue and said, we're going to get behind this as well. And the moment the BTA was in the headline, bam, the whole coalition fell apart. And I felt like the political perception changed. They got 300 comments in the Oregonian about how terrible bikes are. You know, it was just like so polarizing so suddenly. And Kyle used to work for the BTA and now is able to do exactly the same sort of work just as a volunteer for this group that he decided to call Friends of Barber and get together a bunch of mostly bike and pedestrian advocates to be for it, you know, but it's under a different mode. It's a different branding and different messaging and like using the techniques of neighborhood association organizing rather than community bike organizing. That's my case. So that's why I think that like I am cynical about the ability of advocacy groups to really show power in the way that I feel like that you're talking about.
I mean,
I would just say that it's not necessarily something the BTA would have to do, but we need that in our advocacy ecosystem here. We need strong community organizing to happen, you know, and in that case, maybe a better play to not have that polarizing impact would have been for the BTA to sort of be more behind the scenes and help support Friends of Barber, help support what Kyle's doing from behind the scenes, giving him resources, giving him advice, but not coming out in the headline and maybe looking for credit or looking to be the big hero.
But how do they get the resource? I'm switching sides mm-hmm. here, but how then mm-hmm. if they aren't in the headline, how do they go to their funders and say, oh, we helped with that? You know, because like they want to be part of the victory too.
Absolutely.
And they need to be, otherwise they don't have the money to help Kyle.
Well, this is kind of another thing that came up at the summit is there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of work to do. You know, there's not, Friends of Barber is one small issue.
Absolutely.
Of many, many, many issues.
Agreed.
You know, the BTA has a lot of things they could be working on as well. They don't necessarily need to tell the story about everyone. I mean, so I'm just saying ecosystem strength is a real important thing. I think here in Portland, one of the things we're really missing is, I think, really strong strategic sort of community organizing to get people, turning people out. And I think a big part of that is there's nothing on the table. We don't have a short-term goal for how we want bicycling to get better. We just sort of follow a shiny object. Oh, here's, you know, Barber Road Diet has to happen. Oh, over here, you know, there's been some tragedy. We're going to go focus on Vision Zero. Oh, let's go talk about 20's Bikeway. There's no fundamental organizing principle that's everybody can rally around. And I think that's a big gap that we have right now.
Well, so this like whole, where do the resources come from if we're working on a lot of different projects thing? Something that really stuck with me after the National Bike Summit was that we keep talking about how the bicycling is expanding and bicycling commuting has never been as big as it is now. And that it's a growth industry and it's a growth mode. And then we all compete for the same one advocate job at the one local, you know, bike advocacy group. This happens again and again in cities where you see the same exact people that do this work, believing that like the only way that they can have their job be being a voice for cycling is to get a job at a place like the BTA or the CCC. But we see some of the most successful advocates are actually business owners and entrepreneurs like Kyle. You know, he worked for the BTA and then he went and founded the Bike Valet and runs a business now. And he's able to do really effective advocacy on projects when he wants to.
We don't really believe our own arguments in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And so we talk about bicycling is doing great. Everybody loves it. This is, this abundance idea, you know, biking is all these positive things. Yet I see a lot of advocacy groups that have the mentality that there's this limited pool of sort of advocacy mojo. We've got to go capture it. And, you know, we've got to make sure that, you know, we're going to get credit for this. And this is our program. This is our grant, you know, and I see that stuff happening, which, if you believe your argument that biking is awesome and it's taken over, you should know that there's lots of work for everybody to do.
Right.
That's interesting. You know?
So I see that a lot, even at the summit level, at the national level. We don't believe our own research. We don't believe our own arguments. Like, you know, the league themselves has done research that, you know, increasingly we need to move beyond the people that are biking now, right?
Yeah.
Away from the quote unquote bicyclists, right? Yet they did a big rebranding and kept bicyclists in their name. They still use that word on email. So they themselves aren't really, you know, acknowledging that big, you know, sort of language issue and moving past that and talking about that. And there's, you know, there's other examples, you know, where, you know, there's this gap between what we know we have to do versus what these organizations, these advocacy organizations are actually doing. As bicycling has changed so much in recent years in terms of its social acceptance and its usage rates and all that sort of stuff, perhaps we're beyond the point wherein one large advocacy group can kind of handle it all themselves. So the question is, you know, what takes the form of that? You know, what else can do the lift to take bicycling over? What I see is a real big hump we're facing right now.
Right.
You know, we've got pretty good usage numbers, let's say, for America, like in a place like Portland. We've got some of a network sitting there to use, you know, facility-wise, but we still haven't gotten over the big hump. We haven't got double-digit ridership numbers. It's not really normalized here in a lot of ways. Cars still rule Portland, obviously. So the question is, you know, what kind of groups, what's the best way kind of to make that happen? And I think the fact that we're having this conversation and the fact that I've been seeing these things in different moves I've been watching in the city and the fact that there are some conversations even at PBOT right now about this, it really shows that what's the next version of bicycle advocacy? Because right now I think this version is sort of outdated. You know, it's ready for an update. The question is, I don't think anybody's really nailed what that update's going to entail, you know, what it's going to look like.
I think to sum up, we all agree cycling is changing and
right.
The face of cycling is changing, but we haven't agreed how that actually impacts our ability to advocate and the way we advocate. And that's what the cycling movement as a whole needs to figure out, what that next look is. And we've started, we talk about equity and we talk about representation of women and we, you know, talk about being able to get the business community on board, but we haven't really synced that up as what that actually really looks like. We're all just kind of throwing it out there right now. We haven't really figured it out.
So I feel like your concept of like the unifying thing being a sense of fun and I think going along with that sort of like a sense of like, you know, victory and direction and all that, it sort of syncs up with Jonathan's point about there needing to be a rallying cry or a like the role the BTA can play is to say that way, you know, for everybody to be like, oh yeah, that way. All right. That's awesome.
Yeah, and to some extent, they can have a lot to do with what Lily's talking about business development and getting the business voice in. I mean, they're actually doing that a lot. That's been one of their main focuses of very recently is trying to get more business members to become BTA members so that they can, I would assume, sort of harness those business voices for power down the road. Hmm. I'm just seeing, you know, currently important in Portland, our situation right now is the fact that I just don't see anything really exciting on the table. You know, we don't have anybody on city council, including the mayor, that rides their bike mm-hmm. or that really has talked about biking at all, you know, since the last administration left. You know, like I said, the BTA is kind of taking a more behind the scenes conservative partnership building, very important, but that's what they're doing. It's not necessarily a big public thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, where is all this enthusiasm for safe streets? You know, when people need to know that bicycling is a big piece of that and they need to sort of be activated. We need to like flip that switch somehow so that we can sort of at least have that show of force ready when it's necessary.
I will say the only bike event that Novick has showed up to since he was elected was Breakfast on the Bridges. So I want to point
Good
out
argument.
That fun was the way we were able, bike fun was the way we were actually able to get, and he approached us about coming to it and like brought us donuts and healthy snacks because he felt he brought us bananas and a staffer brought us donuts.
Whatever.
But, you know, and he really enjoyed himself and came and hung out with and just talked to bike commuters for 2 hours on a Friday morning. And it was the bike fun that got him out. You know, we didn't and he is very wonky, but he also likes pulling stunts. We've really seen, you know, he likes the letter to Santa asking for more street funding and things like that.
So Steve Novick, Boy Your Prince. That's my question.
Oh. I'll ask him next time I see him at City
Hall. Tune in on the July podcast when we recap Petapalooza.
Oh, Leah Treat said that she was hopefully going to come to Bowie versus Prince this year. So I'm intrigued to see which side she's going to be on.
I want people to know there's not going to be, there's not this sort of zero-sum thing. One solution is going to be the answer. It takes a lot of different things to make a healthy advocacy ecosystem. And when I look out at the scene, I'm just always looking at, okay, which parts are looking a little ill and anemic and which parts need to be bolstered up. And I think, you know, we've identified a few of those here today. And we definitely have some gaps right now.
That Cincinnati was really able to bolster their ability to be bike advocates and really have changed things a lot there is because they focused on certifying bicycle-friendly businesses. And that's how they got their corporate support. And that's also how they were able to be like, look at all of these regular businesses, like the zoo, that are on board with bicycling. So when they go and approach the city, they're able to be like, look, no, we're not just like a crazy fringe group of, you know, spandex wearing road warriors. We're this coalition of very normal businesses that recognize that bicycles is an important way to make Cincinnati attractive to the people we're trying to attract here to come work here. And that's also one of the ways that they fund themselves, you know, with the bicycle friendly certification. So, and they also, bike fun is a very big part of that, I will say.
In Cincinnati.
Too, in there, because they have more, Cincinnati has the most events for Bike Month, actually, of any city in the U.S.
Wow.
Because Portland doesn't really celebrate Bike Month. Right. We have Petapalooza instead. But they have businesses host bike stations with free repair and pastries for cyclists on their morning commute. And they have bike prom, and that's sponsored by like a coffee shop that delivers everything by extra cycle up the hills in Cincinnati. Very impressive.
Wow. Nice.
But
I will say that I think one of the most important triggers of advocacy, definitely that I've seen in some other cities, and I think could be the case here too in Portland, one of the most important triggers is having a marquee facility, having a marquee bike thing in your town that makes the case visually in a very simple way that bicycling does have all these benefits these advocates have been talking about all these years. And I've been saying for a while now that Portland doesn't have that. Mm-hmm. Bike share might be that, but it's delayed. The new bridge, the new car-free bridge at TriMet's building, it could be that. I'm a little dubious.
Especially because at the end of it is the largest bicycle parking area in North America.
Yeah, good plug, Lily. But I mean, I think that bridge is going to depend on the connections and whether they get the connections right. But still, we don't have that marquee thing. Like if we had a cycle track from the Broadway Bridge to PSU, like kind of was promised for the last several years, if there was a dedicated protected bike lane with signal priority and everything, that right there would probably do more for advocacy than any changing of the chairs in some committee or any new strategic direction from the BTA or any community organizing. That one thing, if the city would just go out and make that bikeway, it would make the case overnight, we could stop arguing and getting red faced and trying to convince people about this stuff.
We would never stop arguing
because it would be so obvious. Mm. It would just transform downtown, and everybody would want more of those. I guarantee you, as soon as that went in.
No, I agree with that statement. I also I imagine what that would do for commuting numbers downtown, because we see that interested but concerned slice. One of the, despite downtown actually being statistically the safest place to ride your bike on the city. In the city.
It's not easy to use, though.
It's not easy. And it's a huge, most people do work downtown, worked or at OHSU. And a huge number of people just say that they are comfortable. They ride on the weekends, but they would never be comfortable cycling to work because they're scared of cycling downtown. Mm-hmm. And if we actually had an access piece that met the safety feeling for that interested but concerned group, I think we would see commuting skyrocket.
I agree.
Exactly.
And on that note, that's a great note.
Yeah.
We've solved all of the bike problems in Portland.
We've got a low car tip of the month as usual. Lily, our resident nonprofit funding expert, is going to share some advice with you about how to make your advocacy dollars go further.
Well, Michael asked me, like, what's the best way to give to an advocacy organization? What gets the biggest impact? And one of the biggest recommendations I can make is give monthly. So you might end up actually giving slightly less than you would if you give it just a big check at the end of the year when they're doing their Give Guide campaign or something. But that monthly donation, it's money in the bank every month for your organization. It feels like less out of your pocket, because if you're giving, $10 a month, that you're giving $120 a year, which is more than like a BTA membership costs. But it's only $10 out of your bank account every month. And it's a really... organizations that are applying for grant funding as well as having membership basis, it's a great statistic for them to say that they have this number of sustaining donors, because it shows that there's people that care enough about their work to give every month. So it's, if you can set up sustaining donations, and then you never have to worry about it and you don't have to feel guilty when they're doing their membership drive.
Mm-hmm. Lily, do you have some TriMet tweets of the month to get our dose of transit?
Yes, I do. So Lily Helpinstell says, "You know you're in Portland when the ridiculously friendly bus driver is offering you candy and a toy for Valentine's Day."
Mm-hmm.
Sally Reb says, "So TriMet drivers, what's the policy on holding the bus for passengers to get off for a fist fight?" TriMet Scanner, "It is snowing in Portland. Cue mayhem. Remember, buses do not have schedules when it's snowy." Callium Cook says, "Not sure if it's a Monday morning thing, but since no one thanked the bus driver, I made sure to yell extra loud." And that's our show.
That's our show.
Woo. You can subscribe to the show at bikeportland.org/podcast and send us any comments you have at podcast@bikeportland.org.
You can spread the word about the show by searching for Bike Portland on iTunes and leaving a review.
You can follow me at Anomalily on Twitter.
And you can follow at Bike Portland on Twitter and Facebook too. I'm Jonathan Maas, Bike Portland's publisher.
I'm Michael Anderson, Bike Portland's news editor.
And I'm Lillian Kerbake, your podcast producer. Thanks for listening, and remember to exit through the back,
pass on the left,
and don't forget to thank your bus driver.
Sprocket Studios production.